Boys and girls, how are you? How are you? How are you? I'm in the bunker right down here about, I'm at least 6 feet below the surface of the earth down here. That reminds you of something? Yeah, right. And it's a beautiful day here on August the 19th, 2016. And we're on the downside of August now. If you got something important to do, something really nefarious and naughty, you better get it done, because you don't have too many days to do it, and it'll never come around again, this exact date. That'll be it. You've had your shot. Now, this is Freya's Day. Yeah, Freya's Day here in the bunker. Ladies' Day. She-Wolf Day. Yes, some of my best agents out there are females, I'll tell you that. Women. They can be really sneaky. They can get the information. I've been watching a series called, I forget now, it's about the CIA, and it's pretty good. Their agents go out, and they got a lot of good-looking women working for them, and boy, they have no problem solving a case. They just send these beautiful women out there, and they can fight, too, and they can shoot. How about that? We need more of them. Well, it's a beautiful day here in Indiana, at least in northern Indiana. We got some rain yesterday, but it's full sunshine today. And boy, they got a lot of rain all around us, so I'll tell you that. I drove about 50 miles the other day, and boy, I'll tell you, there was water standing everywhere. Everybody had a fish pond, a new one. I wonder who'll make it down there to Louisiana faster, the Trumpites or the Obamaites. Obama doesn't want to be torn away from his golf game. But don't hold that against him, because all of them are like that. Every president we've had in my lifetime, they were on the golf course most of the time. Yep. Made a lot of their deals on the golf course. I used to know a doctor here in town that carried a couple of grand in his golf bag. He made most of his deals out of that golf bag on a golf course where he couldn't be listened to, couldn't be tapped. Of course, nowadays, there's all kinds of stuff that they can do that. You know, they can even lip read you across the golf course with a pair of binoculars. Getting harder and harder to beat the system, but that's why it's more important than ever to make war against the system. Well, here's a late bulletin that I think you should hear about freedom of speech and how it's going fast.
They voted in this the Muslim mayor Mr. Khan in, I think his name's Mr. Khan, correct, in London as the mayor of London. And the first couple of things, he had some rallies where, you know, women had to be, you know, had to be in certain type of Islamic dress or, you know, appropriate attire. You got an article up as a lead on Breitbart London that is does not augur well for people who like freedom of speech. Can you tell our audience in the United States of America exactly what is going on in London?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe for people like you who are so lucky to live with the First Amendment, but London Mayor's Office for Policing and Crime has just secured £1.7 million of taxpayers' money to fund a dedicated unit of police officers who will be working here in London to tackle trolls and so-called online hate speech. The purpose of this program...
Tell the audience what that means. If you're online in Facebook or Twitter and you're making comments about radical Islam or anything Islam, tell me, is that what you're saying, trolling? They consider that hate speech?
Yeah, it's quote from things that offend, quote, the community. So we had a case less than a month ago.
What is defined as the community?
Well, it's completely subjective. That's the very problem here. That police admit that a hate crime is perceived. It's defined by the person who perceives it. So there is no objective definition of a hate crime. So that's the very problem. It's the root of the problem. You cannot define a hate crime. So now we're going to have a dedicated unit of police officers monitoring and censoring social media here in London.
Hold it. They're criminalizing free speech. They're going to have a unit of police officers online monitoring. So I guess I'm gonna be bailing out you and Raheem on a quite regular basis. Is this what they're telling you? Hey, by the way, London police, please don't go into the comment section of Breitbart London, because your heads are gonna blow up.
Exactly. I mean, and this is not like new to the UK. We've got a law called Section 127 of the Communications Act in 2003. The specific says is the law criminalizes, quote, using a public electronic communication network in order to cause annoyance, inconvenience, or needless anxiety. I mean, that could be interpreted as nearly anything. It can result in a 6-month prison sentence and up to £5,000 fine.
What kind of firestorm do you have in London by The Guardian and The Observer and The Independent and, by the way, BBC, all the paragons of the left that are supposed to be the guardians of free speech?
Well, I mean, The Guardian recently ran a whole campaign called The Web We Want, meaning the web the left want. And they've been pushing for this kind of online censorship for a long time. The Guardian, by default, don't have their comment sections open on anything to do with immigration or Islam. That's been a policy for about 6 months now. And so even just talking about these things in a conversational way in the UK and under the jurisdiction of UK
this is the way they thought they could shut down Brexit. They thought they could shut down the whole Brexit thing by doing this. I mean, they're scared to death of the voices of free men and women. Are they not, Mr. Liam Deacon, in London?
They are, and the EU have played a large role in this. So in May of this year, the EU, we did huge coverage on this in Breitbart. The EU promised that Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Microsoft all signed a commitment to work with national governments and their, quote, law enforcement agencies to perceive, to criminalize illegal hate speech. I mean, this was quite extraordinary. And 3 months later, we're seeing this EU diktat coming into domestic law. And one of the most chilling things about that EU agreement was that they actually promised to recognize the value of independent counter-speech and hateful rhetoric and, quote, promote alternative counter-narratives. So the EU have actually got Microsoft, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube to sign up to re-educating their users. And so that's extraordinary. They're not just censoring conversational things about immigration and Islam. They're actually signed up to promoting and re-educating their users. And when you think about in the modern context how much of political discourse and our modern discussion goes on online and how much is controlled by these four companies, Facebook, Google, Twitter, and Microsoft, they've signed up to control all our modern political discourse from a left-wing point of view. It should be terrifying. It's harder for this to happen in the US because of your protections for free speech. But I wouldn't put it past your political leaders that if this can happen in the supposedly free and liberal Europe, it might not be long until this could happen in the U.S., and you need to hold on to those free leaders.
That's why we have Breitbart London. Europe is the canary in the mine shaft. Liam Deacon from our London office. Fabulous article, Liam. We'll have it up on the homepage.
I wonder if many of you people know how this all got started. Yeah, well, it started on paper and speeches and so forth by the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which is nothing but an offshoot and investigative arm of International B'nai B'rith, Masonic Jewish control network tied in with Zionism around the world. Well, they got a foothold to start in, wouldn't you believe it, sunny, fruity California. And I was there when it started. They called a meeting, a state meeting, in Los Angeles. And they brought in people to testify about having crimes committed against them. They were beaten up and so forth, to testify before this committee. And like I say, I was there. It was held right down there by the by Disneyland. I think it was in the Disneyland Hotel. And one of the key speakers who made the most effect was Gregory Withrow. Believe it or not, Gregory Withrow was a young man who worked with I and John and our people for some time. But he had a problem. He had a drug problem. And he had a lot of personal problems. And he got himself into jams. And he freaked out and went to the press and claimed that our people had waylaid him, nailed him to a cross in the middle of Sacramento, nails through his hands and through his feet. And of course, the media bought the whole thing. In fact, I debated him on national television about it. Well, it turns out, of course, it was totally bogus. Never happened. He's a lying little son of a bitch. But that story of his did more to get the hate crimes laws going in California than anything else. And you know how it goes. What goes in California goes around the world. So that's where the whole hate crime thing started. I was there to see it being born. And that filthy little creep, Gregory Withrow, he's still living up in Northern California, was the cause of it, the beginning of it, the one that really kicked it off. And, of course, then it jumped over into Europe, and they really pushed it fast. They pushed it faster than we did here. So now you know where hate crimes were born, and the white individual who actually had been one of us who kicked it off. The question I have now is, as the future unfolds, how many white people out there are willing to kill and die for the Second Amendment? Or kill and die for the First Amendment? It's a good question because it looks like we're going to get to that point. I see no avoidance of it getting to that point. The time is coming, like over there. They got police now to round up people who say things on the internet that they don't like and throw them in jail. They're already throwing them in jail. Of course, they've had some of these rules for a long time, like, you know, you can't show a swastika or something like that. Bullshit. Either you have free speech or you don't. You can display a hammer sickle. You should be able to display a swastika and so forth. But it's coming pretty fast. I don't have any confidence in either one of the presidential candidates, but I'll tell you one thing. I truly believe that if the bitch gets in there, she's going to push it faster than Trump would. I may be wrong, but I think she is going to marshal her forces of the third world that's doing quite a bit to put her in office. In fact, she wouldn't have a chance if it wasn't for the black vote, the Mexican vote, Asian vote, in other words, all the non-white vote. And the whites don't have much of a chance all by themselves. That's why the politicians are currying favor with non-whites to try to survive instead of fighting. And I mean really fighting. I mean physically fighting. But there's hardly anybody out there like that anymore. But anyhow, I would give notice to the powers that be that there's a certain number of percentage of people still left that'll kill for the First Amendment, and they will kill for the Second Amendment. So if it gets to that, and it starts happening, don't say, well, I can't understand why this is happening. I can't understand why these politicians are being shot down in the streets, blown away in their limousines. Can't understand that. We didn't plan it that way, you know. And what's that thing coming down the street on the back of that pickup truck? My God, it's a guillotine. They're headed for the front of the Capitol in Washington. And I understand there's guillotines rolling up to the front of the state houses around the country, too. So I know that all seems silly. That'll never happen, right? Right? Oh, I don't know. We'll see. I'd surely like to see the look on the face of the first person put under the Aryan guillotine in this country as his head comes rolling into the basket. because you know they're alive for a little bit, the brain's still active, and they're seeing things and so forth. That would be an interesting thing to videotape and put up on the internet. Oh, watch it, Metzger. Terrible Tommy. Moss D says you're the most dangerous man in America. Well, I don't think so. But I could be, maybe. I don't know. We'll see. Here's a little bit more about, we have met the enemy, and the enemy is us. Let's go over to Britain again.
John Barron, distinguished generals, members of the House, let me deal with the gravest calumny that has been leveled at us this evening, namely that we are pacifists. Captain Barron is no pacifist, and neither am I, and I'll fight any man that says I am. We're not making this proposition this evening because we're pacifists. Neither are we in any sense second to the honorable gentleman opposite in our determination to see the defeat of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Neither are we in second place to defend our people and our homeland against terrorism, which is, of course, a separate matter on which we across the House are in agreement. If Al-Qaeda and ISIS come here, we must shoot them dead. And if I'm the mayor of London, I'll be out with our well-armed police force helping them shoot them dead. This is an entirely red herring, a straw man introduced into this debate in order to confuse. I want to see every member of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all the other organizations like them dead on the battlefield. The difference here is our contention that the words Western intervention and ISIS really oughtn't to appear in the same sentence. Because, of course, the West are responsible for ISIS. It was the West who created ISIS, both directly and indirectly. Don't shake your head. Even Tony Blair accepts that. President Obama made the case very clearly just a month or two ago. ISIS, he said, grew out of our invasion and occupation of Iraq. It's an example, he said, of how we should aim before we shoot. And he was right about that. But what is less well known, I'm giving the information. What is less well known? What is less well known is that this game started very much longer ago than that. How did the Taliban and Al-Qaeda come to be? They came to be because the British and American governments, principally using the money of the same satrapies in the Persian Gulf who are paying for the war in Syria now, built up this monster of Islamist fanaticism and extremism. Don't believe me? Watch Rambo 5. Watch Rambo 5 and see the dedication at the end of the movie to the freedom fighters of Afghanistan, who were, of course, to become Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. It goes back even further than that, but I've only got 8 minutes, and it takes me 8 minutes to get my name and address out, generally. So I'll make my point that our culpability in the creation of ISIS is unanswerable, even from the mouths of those who are principally responsible for it. We're responsible for it. I'm giving the information, son. The responsibility is both direct and indirect. We didn't just invade and break and destroy and scatter to the four winds all the pieces of Iraq that have not yet, may never be put back together again. The reason we've got ISIS in Syria is because the same United States and Britain have been pouring money, materiel, weapons, political and diplomatic and propaganda support for the rebels. And every gun, every piece of material that we delivered to the battlefield in Syria ended up in the hands of either ISIS or Al-Qaeda or one of these other groups. That, too, is not contestable. Yes, sir.
Just because we may have a historical responsibility for the actions, the creation of ISIS, does not mean that we have not learned from our mistakes.
Oh, trust me. Trust me, brother. Anybody listening to this debate is only too well aware that you haven't learned from your mistakes. I'm listening to the same kind of Orientalist claptrap that I could have heard at any time in the last few decades. We had a young woman up here saying we needed to educate. No, your point's finished. Somebody actually came here in Oxford and said we need to educate the Iraqis. The Iraqis were teaching algebra when we were painting our faces blue and living in the forest. You think you need to educate the Iraqis? Really? Really? What are you going to educate them in? Military skills? We're not so good at that anymore. The Queen doesn't have enough soldiers. We ran away from Basra under fire, whipped. The United States withdrew from Iraq, beaten by the resistance of the Iraqi people. We're running out of Afghanistan, and we'll be very lucky if it's only the Taliban that come back to power. Because competing against the Taliban is ISIS. The Taliban are the moderates in the fight that's about to ensue. So the West is a military failure, with all respect to the honorable and gallant officers here present this evening. And where's all this money coming from? Where's all the soldiers coming from? How many of you are going to put a tin hat on and go and fight in Syria? Not many, I'll warrant. But where's the money coming from? We can't keep our old age pensioners warm in the wintertime. But you want to go around the world setting fire to other people's countries over and over again, and even go back to the same countries and set fire to them again. I never heard such ridiculous nonsense. Let's deal with our own problems. Let's deal with the problems of our own people. If ISIS come here, we'll kill them. And by the way, the Iraqi army have liberated Tikrit, have liberated Ramadi, will liberate Mosul. Let's give them every support, no doubt, but they don't need Tommy Atkins and his gun to appear there and do it for them. And I've got news for you. The Syrian Arab army, a mainly Sunni army, is winning the war in Syria. It'll soon be over. ISIS and Al-Qaeda will soon be defeated. And the last thing they bloody well need is you lot turning up.
Exclusive. The mainstream, the United States news media, insists that its bias against Donald Trump is an aberration justified by his extraordinary recklessness. But the truth is, the United States media bias has a long history, says longtime journalist Robert Perry. By Robert Perry. The new excuse for the United States mainstream media to violate its professional principles of objectivity and balance in covering this presidential race is that it's all Donald Trump's fault, or as the New York Times put it, Trump is testing the norms of objectivity in journalism. But that is just the latest dodge for American journalists who don't really believe in the principle of even-handedness. Many have been slanting their coverage for as long as I can remember in my nearly four decades covering news in Washington. Tile candidate Donald Trump in an MSNBC interview. Indeed, bias and outright dishonesty have long been the norm for major American news outlets, especially in the fabrication of foreign monsters around the world for the United States military to seek out and destroy. The truth is that at virtually every spin of America's revolving wheel of enemies, the New York Times could write a similar headline blaming the foreign leaders, just as the newspaper did Trump. Putin tests the norms of objectivity in journalism, or Bashar al-Assad or Saddam Hussein or any other designated villain du jour. In the Times framing of the problem, it's not the journalists who have a responsibility to maintain the norms of objectivity, it is Trump or some foreign villain who tests the norms. The journalists are the victims here, with their high standards being put under unfair pressure. But I can't remember a time when major the United States news outlets approached a foreign policy issue with anything approaching objectivity or balance. With very few exceptions, the pattern is to fall in line behind the United States foreign policy establishment's propaganda. Indeed, when some of us have tried to apply objective or even-handed standards to foreign controversies, we faced resistance and punishment from our own news organizations. We learned that very few senior editors would challenge even the most blatant nonsense from the State Department or the White House. After all, that's how they got to be senior editors. Whether it was Nicaragua's Sandinistas in the 1980s, or Iraq and Serbia in the 1990s, or Iraq, again, and Iran in the 2000s, or Syria, Russia, China, and Iran, again, today, the United States star reporters chucked aside even the pretense of fairness in favor of careerism. The more you pile on these enemies, the better for you. Along with these longer-term enemies, there are short-term villains who are transformed into cartoon characters almost overnight, such as Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych. Though elected by the voters, he was made into a black hat in 2013 and 2014 because he wouldn't go along with an economic deal with Europe that involved harsh reforms from the International Monetary Fund. Yanukovych also was considered an ally of neighboring Russia, so he got the full propaganda treatment from the United States government agencies and their client journalism outfits, such as the United States aid-funded Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Those anti-Yanukovych themes, in turn, were picked up and amplified by mainstream the United States media outlets, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. So, on February 22, 2014, when Ukraine's elected president was violently overthrown in a putsch spearheaded by neo-Nazis and other ultranationalist street fighters, the West's media almost universally cheered the coup as a victory for democracy. No self-awareness. Of course, the abandonment of objectivity and honesty is not a new story in American journalism. In reality, there has long been a selfing suspension of self-awareness on the part of the United States media figures who still view themselves through the heroic but now foggy and yellowed prism of the Pentagon Papers and Watergate. Yet, the pervasive bias in reporting on international crises is not just dishonest journalism in some academic sense. It also has helped the military-industrial complex soak the United States taxpayers of trillions of dollars and enabled official Washington to dispatch American soldiers to fight endless blood-soaked wars. Arguably, what's different now is that this pattern of bias, which has been common in the United States coverage of international affairs for years, has now spread to the United States politics. But even that's not especially new. The political pack has often had its favorites and has barely tried to conceal its desired outcome. For instance, in campaign 2000, which turned out to be one of the most significant elections in American history, the cool press corps kids covering the race between Al Gore and George W. Bush were smitten by Bush, the regular guy who gave them neat nicknames, while Gore was a boring wonk. The anti-Gore journalistic sneering was palpable as reporters gleefully misreported key campaign moments, such as the bogus quote attributed to Gore that "I invented the internet" and other boasts that Gore never made. The mocking of Gore and the fawning over Bush continued into the coverage of the Florida recount, which gave the White House to Bush, though Gore got more legal votes both in Florida and nationally. For details, see Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. While the hotshot campaign reporters saw campaign 2000 as a something of a lark, since the catastrophic consequences of Bush's presidency were still in the future today, the mainstream media justifies its lack of objectivity as something of a duty to the nation. As Jim Ruttenberg wrote for The Times, if you're a working journalist and you believe that Donald J. Trump is a demagogue playing to the nation's worst racist and nationalistic tendencies, that he cozies up to anti-American dictators and that he would be dangerous with control of the United States nuclear codes, how the heck are you supposed to cover him? Because if you believe all of those things, you have to throw out the textbook American journalism has been using for the better part of the past half century, if not longer, and approach it in a way you've never approached anything in your career. If you view a Trump presidency as something that's potentially dangerous, then your reporting is going to reflect that. You would move closer than you've ever been to being oppositional. That's uncomfortable and uncharted territory for every mainstream, known opinion journalist I've ever known, and by normal standards, untenable. Ruttenberg acts as if he's never given a thought to the prejudicial journalism that his own newspaper routinely shows in its coverage of foreign issues. See, for instance, ConsortiumNews.com's NYT's Orwellian view of Ukraine. A Trump-Putin twofer. In the Trump bashing, there's also been a merger with the bashing of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump is sometimes accused of being a Russian agent because he believes that the United States can cooperate with Russia on fighting terrorism and other issues, rather than just rush to confront nuclear-armed Russia in a costly and dangerous new Cold War. Amid the media frenzy over this so-called Trump-Putin bromance, Trump suggested that the Russians might be able to find Hillary Clinton's missing 30,000 State Department emails. Though obviously meant as a joke referring to the suspicions that Russia was involved in hacking the Democratic National Committee's emails, the comment was widely interpreted in the mainstream the United States media as an act approaching treason. Or as Ruttenberg put it, Trump sought to entice Russia to meddle in a United States presidential election by hacking his opponent, a joke, Mr. Trump later said, that the news media failed to get. Though it's certainly true that some of Trump's offhand remarks, like suggesting that Second Amendment people could take action to stop Clinton's gun control plans, cross the line into the reckless, Trump's email comment was surely not some serious appeal to the Russians to spy on Clinton. If he were serious, he surely would never have made the appeal publicly. But the more important point is that the American people need to recognize that the major the United States news media on foreign policy issues is deeply biased in line with what the United States foreign policy establishment wants. with Trump and Putin, the media gets a twofer. And there is no conspiracy here. It's just that if a foreign policy or national security reporter wants to get access to the United States government information, much of it classified, he or she must show a readiness to take the United States side. If not, the next time there's a major event, say, the United States military strike or the preparation of a government report on a foreign crisis, your competition will get the inside story TikTok or the document leak, not you. Then, your editors will want to know how you got beat. They won't want to hear excuses about how you've given the United States government authorities a hard time on some serious investigative project. Your editors will just want to have what the competition has, and if you can't get it, they will happily give your job to someone who will play ball with the powers that be. As for American journalists, they should come clean about their obvious biases, or they should commit themselves to an oppositionist position vis-a-vis all government officials, regardless of which government they represent and what the personal career consequences might be. One standard should fit all. But that's just wishful thinking. The best career path for media stars is to be dishonest, to pretend that you're faithfully abiding by professional journalistic standards, except in some extreme cases like Trump's presidential candidacy or in writing about some foreign villain. Then, you're just doing what's good for the country. Investigative reporter Robert Perry broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s. You can buy his latest book, America's Stolen Narrative, either in print here or as an ebook, from Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
Now, I may be duplicating some of the show that I already did, but I did about 20 minutes, and I lost it, and I'm not sure what I put back on. So anyhow, this is pretty important, I'm sorry if you got to listen to it twice, but this is about hate crimes and something you better be really getting ready to think about what you will do.
Now go to London. Liam Deacon in our London office. Liam, they voted in this the Muslim mayor, Mr. Khan. In London as the mayor of London, and the first couple of things, he had some rallies where women had to be in certain type of Islamic dress or appropriate attire. You got an article up as a lead on Breitbart London that is does not augur well for people who like freedom of speech. Can you tell our audience in the United States of America exactly what is going on in London?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe for people like you who are so lucky to live with the First Amendment, but London Mayor's Office of Policing and Crime has just secured £1.7 million of taxpayers' money to fund a dedicated unit of police officers who will be working here in London to tackle trolls and so-called online hate speech. The purpose of this program.
Tell the audience what that means. If you're online in Facebook or Twitter and you're making comments about radical Islam or anything Islam, tell me, is that what you're saying? Trolling? They consider that hate speech?
Yeah, it's quote from things that offend quote the community. So we had a case less than a month ago.
What is defined as the community?
Well, it's completely subjective. That's the very problem here. That police admit that a hate crime is perceived, it's defined by the person who perceives it. So there is no objective definition of a hate crime. So that's the very problem. It's the root of the problem. You cannot define a hate crime. So now we're going to have a dedicated unit of police officers monitoring and censoring social media here in London.
Hold it. They're criminalizing free speech. They're going to have a unit of police officers online monitoring. So I guess I'm gonna be bailing out you and Raheem on a quite regular basis. Is this what they're telling me? Hey, by the way, London police, please don't go into the comment section of Breitbart London because your heads are gonna blow up.
Exactly. I mean, and this is not like new to the UK. We've got a law called Section 127 of the Communications Act in 2003. And the specific says is the law criminalizes, quote, using a public electronic communication network in order to cause annoyance, inconvenience, or needless anxiety. I mean, that could be interpreted as nearly anything. It can result in a 6-month prison sentence and up to £5,000 fine.
What kind of firestorm do you have in London by The Guardian and The Observer and The Independent and, oh, by the way, BBC, all the paragons of the left that are supposed to be the guardians of free speech?
Well, I mean, The Guardian recently ran a whole campaign called The Web We Want, meaning the web the left want. And they've been pushing for this kind of online censorship for a long time. The Guardian, by default, don't have their comment sections open on anything to do with immigration or Islam. That's been a policy for about 6 months now. And so even just talking about these things in a conversational way in the UK and under the jurisdiction of UK law, this is the way they
thought they could shut down Brexit. They thought they could shut down the whole Brexit thing by doing this. I mean, they're scared to death of the voices of free men and women. Are they not, Mr. Liam Deacon, in London?
They are, and the EU have played a large role in this. So in May of this year, the EU, we did huge coverage on this in Breitbart. The EU promised that Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Microsoft all signed a commitment to work with national governments and their, quote, law enforcement agencies to perceive, to criminalize illegal hate speech. I mean, this was quite extraordinary. And 3 months later, we're seeing this EU diktat coming into domestic law. And one of the most chilling things about that EU agreement was that they actually promised to recognize the value of independent counter-speech and hateful rhetoric and, quote, promote alternative counter-narratives. So the EU have actually got Microsoft, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube to sign up to re-educating their users. And so that's extraordinary. They're not just censoring conversational things about immigration and Islam. They're actually signed up to promoting and re-educating their users. And when you think about in the modern context how much of political discourse and our modern discussion goes on online and how much is controlled by these four companies, Facebook, Google, Twitter, and Microsoft, they've signed up to control all our modern political discourse from a left-wing point of view. It should be terrifying. It's harder for this to happen in the US because of your protections for free speech. But I wouldn't put it past your political leaders that if this can happen in the supposedly free and liberal Europe, it might not be long until this could happen in the US. And you need to hold on to those free.
That's why we have Breitbart London. Europe is the canary in the mine shaft. Liam Deacon from our London office. Fabulous article, Liam. We'll have it up on the homepage all day today.
Well, there you go, boys and girls. They're coming, man. I'll tell you. You know, this all started out pretty much with World War II, or the aftermath of World War II and the 6 million story and all that kind of stuff. It started with saying that you couldn't walk in the streets with a swastika flag or anything like hand out National Socialist literature with a swastika on, things like that. So they got that passed in all these countries over there. And then it skipped the pond. And the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which was an investigative arm of the B'nai B'rith International, which I never hear right-wing talk about. They may talk about it, but I never hear them. They only talk about the ADL and the Jews. And they don't talk about the differences between the Zionists and the Orthodox and all that stuff, too. But anyhow, they started pushing it here in this country. So if you ever want to remember and go back after all this turns into whatever it's going to turn into, you'll know who to blame. So anyhow, they started pushing, and all the ADL has to do is go into these congressmen and senators' office and scream anti-Semitism, and they'll do anything and even get down and give them fellatio. That's all it takes for these big-shot Jews. Well, anyhow, the governor of California called for a big meeting in L.A. Well, actually, it was at the Disneyland Hotel. And on this kind of a problem. So I went to it and didn't realize this was the launching pad for hate crimes legislation. And they had several people come in from around the state, mostly people, just non-whites who'd been beat up or something like that, and crying and moaning about how horrible it was and how white people are terrible. Well, the one guy that came there had quite an effect on the crowd because he was a regular little showman. That was Gregory Withrow, who I befriended when he was a 16-year-old kid. Thought I got him out of drugs and got him on the right path. He started the White Student Union at the college, the university there in Sacramento, and made quite a bit of media across the country. And that led to some other people doing the same thing. But he went back into drugs and went nuts. And he became an outcast as far as we're concerned. And then all of a sudden he comes up with a crazy story. Because he had done some crazy things like brandishing a sawed-off shotgun, driving down the street and things like that. Well, anyhow, he appeared before this outfit to testify. And he testified that Tom Metzger and his boys had waylaid him in Sacramento and nailed him to a cross. I can't dream this up. This is true that he accused us of that. Of course, we never even were questioned by the police about it. Because the sheriff of Sacramento County up there, he knew it was bullshit, but he didn't want to get involved, so he let him get away with telling the story. So he testified all that and how horrible we were, and we were almost killed him and all that. But anyhow, the results of all the testimony to this group resulted in the beginning of the drafting of hate crimes legislation in California. Yeah. That's where it really got started. And that's, you know, how it is, California. Whatever California does spreads around the country. And from there it spread around the country. And now it's going back across the pond and developed from just having a swastika tattoo or something on you or marching down the street with a swastika flag. It's gone to this hate crime situation. And now it's going to the extreme, to where they're going to go on the internet and check everybody out for anything. And these companies, internet companies, are going to go along with them. And it won't be long till it'll come here. It's already come here to a degree. Somebody said something about 22,000 or million people had been bumped off Twitter for their naughty speech. In just the last few weeks or months, I got part of that off of the radio speaker, but I missed some of it. So anyhow, we're going to have to come to a decision as time goes on here in this country, which we should have come to a long time ago, probably. We're going to have to decide whether we're going to be slaves or not slaves, whether we're going to fight or not fight. And I don't mean it's bullshit getting up in front of a bunch of skinheads and say, we got to fight, we got to get him, we got to kill him. I'm talking about regular pro-white people are going to have to decide whether they're willing to die for free speech, for the First Amendment. I mean die for the First Amendment or die for the Second Amendment. Now, most of the people who yap and go on and on about how they support the Second Amendment and First Amendment and all that are bullshitters, because the minute the heat comes down at all, they cave in. So I'm talking that there's a lot of people out there who will not cave in. And the establishment, the ruling class, better understand that. That they're not, there's a certain percentage of people in this country that will kill to maintain their rights of free speech and Second Amendment and assembly. Yeah. And if they don't think so, just keep pushing. Just keep pushing. Homeland Security out there, it's just fun and games is not going to go on forever. And when it starts, don't complain to me. It's going to get mean. Blacks are going to get mean. Whites are going to get mean. And they're going to be all looking for the ruling class and the political leaders who have screwed them. Most of them are not going to be concerned with the Mickey Mouse things on the corner, beating up non-whites on the street, things like that. They're going to go for the throat of the big boys. And most of them won't get through and they'll sacrifice their lives, but some of them will get through. This is sort of like what really promoted the Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Taliban. We never should have been over there supplying the Afghanis with weapons to kill the Russians. That was none of our business. I know about it because I was somewhat a little bit on the periphery involved in a civilian kind of way with a person that evidently was CIA and I didn't know it. But every time we get into these countries and start meddling around, we create far more enemies than we eliminate. And so that's what's happening with us, you see. The system always does the same thing. The system always operates the same way. If anybody starts bitching or demonstrating, beat their heads in. If you have to, shoot them. But then that always leads to just a few who say, screw you, we're going to war with you, and we're going to kill you. And they attract a certain amount of more people, and sooner or later you got a guerrilla operation, whether it's an Arab or Muslim or Buddhist or radical Christian or radical racist or what it is. Now, if you were listening to the news last night, now that they've appointed this Breitbart leader, they're really coming unglued that the right wing is really going crazy. The extreme right wing, they're really going crazy, man. Oh, last night they were screaming and yelling, and oh, my God, oh, my God. Well, I'm glad that's oh, my God, because something may be good coming out of this after all. And it's going to be promoted by our opposition because they go crazy. They see the system right now, and for a long time, has used the left wing, mostly. They've used the right wing, yeah, but not as much. They've used the left wing. But when they get tired of using the left wing, they simply change their tune and go over and use the right wing. Or they use them both together in tandem. So you got to make sure you're not being used by one of them, one or the other. You'll know when you're being used, or you should. I learned that a long time ago. Most of the right wing in this country never learned that they were being used. And certainly the left wing, most of them haven't learned that. However, there is a percentage of left wingers that are kick-ass and understand the situation. And that's fine. Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's about it for today, Freya's Day. I'll be back with you Moon's Day. Hopefully they haven't dragged me out of this bunker by then. And we'll do it again, but I'm going to keep giving you as truthful a situation as I can, and I'm not going to coat it with sugar. I'm going to give it to you the hard way, and I would hope that a lot of these people that are wasting their time with Mickey Mouse activities in the right wing or handing out papers for the KKK and stuff like that in the middle of the night and all that kind of bullshit would get off their high horse and come down and talk turkey about lone wolf activity and so forth and looking ahead to what we're going to be facing. I doubt whether most of them will because they're going to go along with this plastic man approach and, we're going to run him for office. Well, then what's he going to do? Well, he's going to do something. Well, what do you think he's going to do? Well, he's going to try to get a law through to protect white people. Well, What if he don't have a goddamn chance in hell of doing it? Then what are you going to do? Well, I don't know. We'll have to get somebody else to run, or we got to... Oh, I know. We'll start an organization. Yeah. We'll call it the White Boys Place, you know? Well, then what are you going to do with that organization? Well, we're going to study the problem. We're going to look into it. We're going to try to come up with some answers. Maybe run somebody else for office. How about that? You see how the bullshit goes around and around and around? It's been going on for 45 years of my life, and I've had it. I finally got goosed and walked straight. See you Monday.
Riding north on Interstate 75, with a nervous fading beauty sitting by his side, and a pistol that he used to pay. Riding north on Interstate 75, with a nervous fading beauty sitting by his side, and a pistol that he used to pave the way down the long black stretches of a dark highway. Ray bought his future with a pound of lead, and he robbed him at the store and left the clerk dead. That kid should have put the money in the sack, but he didn't, and now there ain't no turning back. He's a Jesse Ryder, he's a Jesse James. Best thing he can hope for is a household name. There ain't nobody there to plan to trust when all people get mad. We ain't notorious. There ain't nobody there to plan to trust when all people get mad. We ain't notorious. They pulled out and started days back 12 o'clock. The East Road with the lights off for the roadblock. Break you the motor at the county line. Changes Tennessee blades to a lost tag sound. Jesus never asked what the boy had done. He said he'd be his hostage if he needed love. Her mom raised her to the Lord of truth. If you're best believed, she can do. She was always lonely on the midnight ride. We left the body to a poor man's back. It ain't too easy when the man you love has got a reputation that's notorious. It ain't too easy when the man you love has got a reputation that's notorious. They were just outside of Knoxville when the lights flashed on, and the sirens started howling like hell hound dog. Red carpet fired into overdrive. Swore he'd never let them take him alive. He was a Jesse Ryder, he was a Jesse James. The best he ever hoped for was a household name. The morning papers didn't say it too much, but he was to every man no story. Thank you.